Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Michelle Rayner, and welcome to Hindsight here on ABC Radio National. Philanthropy is a word seldom used and little understood in Australia. Its literal meaning is love of mankind, but nowadays we use the word most often to refer to the giving away of money. And when we do think of Australian philanthropy, it's usually men who come to mind: Sidney Meyer, Sir Ian Potter, and Richard Pratt. Less well known are the small number of women who, alongside many of these men, have also given away significant amounts of money to charitable causes in Australia. Some have been motivated by religion, some by politics, some by family, and some by love. In today's Hindsight, we explore the stories of eight of Australia's most generous women who've given away their money over the last 100 years. From the little-known story of Anne Bonn, who late last century devoted her life and large amounts of her own farming fortune to the plight of Aboriginals, through to the more recent waves of women whose philanthropy has been shaped by the political and social movements of the 1960s and 70s. Here's a great form of love: women philanthropists in Australian history, and it's presented by Barbara Lemon.
Man is called to exercise responsible love, and this love has also to be manifested in the sphere of the material.
Philanthropy is a sharing of one's spirit and one's resources to encourage and bring out that which is within in people with something to give to our society. But I think it is always, for me, focused and specific, an act of hope. Hope is a great form of love.
Most people have great respect for the notion of philanthropy, but I do think there are people who see it as perhaps, in its traditional form, just maintaining the status quo.
Australia has a strong tradition of philanthropy, albeit not of the moneyed kind modelled in America. In 1880, pastoralist's wife, Elizabeth Austin, made headlines in the colony with a £6,000 gift to build the Austin Hospital in Melbourne. But, until recent years, few Australian women have been in a position to give away large amounts of money. Instead, the tradition of Australian women's philanthropy is rooted in voluntary work. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, voluntary work was an essential part of the social role of middle and upper class women. Many were also driven by deep religious faith. Those who were able to give money favoured churches, educational institutions, and hospitals. Few would have dared use their wealth to instigate any kind of social reform. 19th century Scottish emigre Anne Fraser Bonn was an exception.
She was a Scottish woman who came out as a young bride, like 19 years old, and came out to Australia in 1858 when there was very little infrastructure in the country. She came out to a pastoral property, and there was no house. It was just a sort of a small kind of dwelling, and was expected to be the wife and live in that kind of wild environment. There was only men around, plus Aboriginal women and a couple of servants who came over in the boat. You know, through a whole series of events, she then became very attached to the Aboriginal people. She went on to champion their cause and became the first woman on the board for the protection of Aborigines. And she fought for the betterment of Aborigines right up until her death at 98.
In 1858, Anne Bonn settled with her husband John and her sister Jane at Wappen Station in northeast Victoria. John Bonn was 33 years older than his wife, who successfully farmed the land at Wappen, making the Bonns wealthy. Playwright and biographer of Anne Bonn, Heather Matthew.
Well, by all accounts, the locals didn't particularly like her. She was very authoritarian. She was very autocratic. She was really not particularly liked, nor was she particularly understood by local people in that kind of pastoral, colonial society in a small country town. She was very, not the word respected, but she was certainly had a position of some authority. She had a lot of money. She was a staunch Presbyterian, so she gave a lot of things to help the local church in Mansfield, the church at Bonnie Doon, and she also dabbled in a whole lot of other philanthropic kind of things.
Anne Bond gave generously to Melbourne's New Austin Hospital, the Charity Organisation Society and the Salvation Army. Toward the end of the century, she set up a second home in Kew as a refuge for the sick and needy. She established a school in Melbourne for Chinese children and took in mentally ill patients. During the First World War, Anne Bond even donated an ambulance to the Belgian Army and gave £20 to every blinded soldier in Victoria at Christmas time each year. But Anne Bond's greatest passion and strongest focus was always the protection of the Aboriginal people near her home in Victoria's northeast. Frustrated by the ineptitude of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines, she joined it to strengthen her fight for better conditions at the mission station called Corranderk.
Letter from Anne Bond to the Under-Secretary of the Chief Secretary's Department, Q, 29th of May, 1882. My dear Mr. Wilson, I am sure you will not regard it as a presumption on my part to make a few suggestions regarding the future management of the Aborigines of Corranderk. We have robbed them of their beautiful colony, deprived them of their hunting fields and fishing grounds, and given them in return our vices and diseases which are rapidly doing their work. And are they to be driven from place to place like a herd of cattle to make room for the white usurper? They are capable of feeling joy and sorrow as well as we, and I believe their attachments are much stronger than ours. They are neither paupers, lunatics, or criminals. Then why treat them as such? The clothes they receive from their protectors very much resemble those worn by the inhabitants of Pentridge. They have been refused straw and were sleeping on rushes, and added to their comfort they had plenty of bugs. In their primitive state their temporal wants were well supplied. They possess far more intellect than they get credit for, and the greatest crime of which they have then been guilty is having been the original owners of the soil. The present management is demoralising, the board has proved a perfect failure, and the only remedy is its abolition.
The story of Anne Bond came to light for Heather Matthew 10 years ago. In fact, Anne Bond visited Heather in a dream as she was camping on the Hawkwa River in country Victoria, not far from the place where Anne Bond once lived. In the dream, Anne instructed Heather to write a play about her, and she was not one to be disobeyed. Heather's play, The Widow of Wappen, was performed in 2003.
My research then led to finding out about this remarkable story about this woman, Anne Bond, who donated her husband's marble tombstone to be resurfaced and re-erected as a monument to William Barak, the last Ngunnawal of the Wurundjeri people. So what would lead this woman to do that?
A babe in heaven. I knew a lovely infant girl who only lived one day. Angelic beauty she possessed, but here she could not stay. The mother loved that darling babe. She was her firstborn child. And hard it was to part with her, so pure and undefiled.
In 1860, 2 years after she arrived in Australia, Anne Bond gave birth to her first child, a girl, but the infant lived just one day.
This was sort of an important moment because she's there by herself. There's only her sister Jane, who is young and, by all accounts, doesn't know too much about birthing. There's a couple of servants, and something goes terribly wrong. The baby dies. In talking to an Aboriginal elder from the Wurundjeri people, who is actually William Barrack's great niece. She and I sort of worked out that perhaps that was a pivotal moment when there was a connection between these two people, because this was to go on right up further on even than William Barrack's death. It went right up to her death and Bond's death, this connection and relationship she had with William Barrack. And we think that perhaps William Barrack, whose wife had a child at that stage, which also died, perhaps they were united in grief. I don't know, but this is where we think that perhaps there was this heart connection that happened.
Tyre's Aborigines. The power of God is infinite. He pitieth the destitute and them that go astray, neglected by their fellow men and ruled by Satan's sway. Yet they are precious in his sight, more precious than fine gold. When Christ comes to claim his kingdom, they shall in his glory share.
Over the next decade, Anne bore four more children, but only two survived. Her eldest son, John, died at the age of 35, and her daughter, Wilhelmina, died at 22. Two sons, David and William, survived. In 1868, after just 10 years of marriage, her husband John also died. Anne Bond's biographer, Heather Matthew.
And everybody expected that she'd, you know, up and do some genteel thing, but she said, no, I'm staying on and keeping the farm going, which was very unusual. By this stage, they had a nice house, they had Chinese gardeners, they had lots of servants, lots of people working there, and also the people from Corranderk would come back and work on the property, and they paid them. They paid them wages, which was very unusual for the time as well, because the Aborigines weren't being paid wages. So Mrs. Bond kept this relationship going with the Aboriginal people that she'd had a strong relationship with at Wappen. When they went to Corranderk, she kept that going.
In 1930, Anne Bond's property at Wappen Station was acquisitioned by the government to make way for the new Sugarloaf Weir and Lake Eildon. The grave of her husband and baby daughter would soon be submerged. In light of this, Anne donated the tombstone they shared to the Australian Natives Association to be resurfaced and dedicated as a memorial to Aboriginal leader and friend William Barrack. Anne herself retired to the Windsor Hotel in Melbourne, where her son William visited her every day. She lived there as a recluse until her death in 1936, aged 98.
Adieu to Bonnie Doon. I bid adieu to Bonnie Doon, its banks and braes so green, where I have spent so many years and many changes seen. I love to walk adown its strath or climb the Wappen hills, which stand as sentinels to guard the home from threatened ills. I now must bid adieu, my friends. We hope to meet in heaven, where cruel partings are unknown. Thanks to the Lord be given.
Certainly she considered that Christianity was a very, very strong thing that should be spread amongst Aboriginal people and amongst Chinese people, and, you know, she was a great and devout Christian. But I don't think that she ever thought that they were less, you know, and I think that's really important, that they were there as common humanity. She believed in that. She got on the wrong side of people because she didn't have any social skills in terms of what women were supposed to be doing, you know, flouncing around in frilly petticoats and parasols and things. She staunchly walked. If she wanted the garden dug, she would send a spade in the mail to the person who was to dig it. That was his signal that it was time for him to come to Mrs. Bond's house and dig the garden. So she just didn't have any of that kind of niceties, cucumber sandwich kind of stuff. And she, you know, she treated her sister as a servant. So Jane ended up kind of being the nanny of the children, because Mrs. Bond was out there doing a job in a man's world, I guess.
By the end of World War II, many Australian women were out there in a man's world. War meant increasing numbers of women going to work and increasing numbers remaining unmarried. In both cases, women gained control of money. The implications for women's philanthropy were far-reaching.
Man is called to exercise responsible love, and this love has also to be manifested in the sphere of the material.
The late Dr. Una Porter was the daughter of Fred Cato, the wealthy owner of giant grocery chain Moran and Cato. In 1930, Una began studying medicine at the University of Melbourne and became a fully qualified psychiatrist. She helped to run her father's charitable trust and later became world president of the Young Women's Christian Association, the YWCA. But this was just the public face of Una Porter's charitable work. Behind the scenes, she gave well over $1 million of her own money to hospitals, universities and Christian organisations. Former federal Liberal politician Dame Margaret Guilfoyle was Una Porter's friend and colleague.
Well, I first met her in the late 1960s, and at that time she was the world president of the YWCA. It was a voluntary body, and I became the national treasurer. And she was always an active member of that executive. She was a very busy woman. She was, I think, an inspirational kind of person. When she arrived at the meeting, you always felt that you had things that had to be discussed at a certain level, and she brought that leadership quality into the YWCA. And if we're looking at the timing of this, say the late 60s, a lot of the work of the YWCA was with newly arrived migrants post-war, and Good Neighbour Council, all of those things. There was a cross-referencing of community work. And so Una Porter was very involved and, I think, inspirational in a whole lot of that.
Refugees and migrants, we bring before your fatherly love all those who are homeless upon the face of the earth, all who live in camps, who have no work to do, who have lost their birthright of the dignity of labour and a share in its rewards. Fill our hearts with a deep compassion, our minds with enlightened understanding.
Una Porter was the youngest of eight children, but her childhood was marred by the deaths of three siblings. The two closest in age to her, Jack and Lois, died within months of one another. Tragically, Lois drowned in a pond, while she and the four-year-old Una were playing together. The incident marked Una for life. As an adult, she took a great interest in the study of early childhood development. Una married late, at 46, and had no children of her own. Friend and colleague Dame Margaret Guilfoyle.
She was not a vivacious personality. She was not someone who walked into a room and jollied everybody up or anything like that. But when she did come into a room, there was a presence there that was recognised. And I think it was more a respectful relationship she had with everybody whom she met, rather than one that became personal. And I can only say that there was warmth. While there might have been discipline or reserve or whatever in her personality, there was always warmth in the way that she spoke, either publicly or personally to anybody. And there was that generosity of spirit I think we all valued.
Christmas Circular, November 1938. My most recent thrill has been the purchase of a small four-roomed cottage at Olinda for the use of the unemployed or sick families I come across in the charitable fund work I do. So many need holidays, and I find it very difficult to arrange for them often. This is going to be a wonderful boon to many of them, and also my gardener can go occasionally and tend the garden there. I hope to put my first family in over Christmas.
Una Porter's philanthropy was directed largely to institutions like the Epworth Hospital, Monash University, or the University of Melbourne, where she funded a scholarship, a chair in psychiatry, and a college chapel. But it would be impossible to count the number of incidental gifts made over her lifetime. In 1971 alone, Una gave $135,000 in what she recorded as gifts to friends, and she travelled the world at her own expense to carry out work on behalf of the YWCA. In addition, Una Porter did an enormous amount to champion the cause of women. In 1972, she lobbied every state premier to oppose the new tax on contraceptives. She was quoted as saying, "The government seems to think that bringing children into the world is a form of amusement." Yet, Una Porter described the woman's struggle as, quote, "a misplaced goal for the expenditure of energies," and never aligned herself with organised feminism.
If we're looking at being a product of our time, and the time I'm talking about is, say, 67 to 70 when I first met her during the years that I was chairman of the women's section. At that time, feminist groups and women's groups were starting to be established. The YWCA was very active in looking at the opportunities that could be given to women. A lot of those were in training for leadership in organisations or in sporting bodies. There was a lot of Y work done for women to give them the confidence to look for a more involved role in the whole community. So she was active in that, but not in the sense of giving leadership. She was not the person who was saying that the women must have equal opportunity. It was always to assist a community rather than to be looking separately at the role that women could be playing. But she always recognised the essence of a good community life was probably the voluntary work that women did.
It has always been my desire that God should use me in his service. I have had an abiding concern and love for individual people and for all peoples, knowing that the problems of the countries of the world are the problems of the people who inhabit them. Where there are underprivileged people, they need help. If underprivileged physically, then I have hoped to help them through my medical training or through my work in the refugee field. If they are underprivileged mentally or nervously, my psychiatric training has equipped me to give assistance. Then, through the YWCA, the church, and latterly the WCC, I have tried to grow spiritually, so that God might use me and perhaps at times mediate his love through me. What I have done is infinitesimal, but I have loved doing it.
I do think that she had a genuine Christian experience that was very important to her, and I think that that was conveyed in the way that she worked with other people. She would be someone with the self-confidence to take leadership in a quiet way, and to have influence. If I would think of, say, five people that I would remember as being influential to me, I would put her in that group.
Conscientious, conservative and Christian, Una Porter may seem to belong to a bygone era, but she was in fact a contemporary of Australia's best-known woman philanthropist.
Excuse me. Hello? Speaking. Yes, 22nd of October, the afternoon. I think I'll be here, yes. About 3:30?
Mm-hmm.
Just send me a note. Good, thanks. Yeah. Oh, well, of course, there's the Murdoch Children's Institute, paramount importance in my life. The McClellan Gallery, Tapestry Workshop, Education of the Deaf, Music, University of Melbourne, Landscape Architecture, there's a chair there in my name.
For Dame Elizabeth Murdoch, philanthropy is a full-time job, and there is no prospect of retirement. Dame Elizabeth spends much of her time responding to the hundreds of letters that she receives every week asking for financial aid, and to this day, she supports 110 charitable organisations per year. We spoke at her home, the picturesque Cruden Farm, outside Melbourne.
There are a lot of major things I support, but then there are a lot of other things that, you know, I perhaps just give them 1,000 or 10,000 or 5,000, but those things I've enumerated are perhaps the closest to my heart. Of course, I'm passionate about my garden.
Yes, and the botanic gardens you're now
patron. Yes, and I'm the patron. I'm very proud of that. I forgot to mention that. It's the very first patron, so it was a big honour. Been so much part of my life since I was a child, because when I was young, there was no entertainment. The only entertainment we provided for us was to be taken to the gardens to feed the ducks. And from then, right up through my life, I've been involved in the Botanic Gardens, so I feel that in a way it's justified for me to be the patron. I never take on patronage unless I can be involved, work and help.
In 1933, already the proud mother of Helen and Rupert, a young Lady Murdoch was invited to join the Committee of Management of the Royal Children's Hospital.
Well, of course, it was a great honour to be asked onto the board, but I was very inexperienced, and but I felt I should, because I was so fortunate to have two healthy children, and I did feel that if they wanted me, if I could be of help, it was a great honour, and I'd do my best. And of course, I was there all those 33 years following that. I hadn't been experienced in philanthropy and didn't really become very philanthropic for quite a number of years, although I gave up my services and did all I could, but I didn't have the means to be philanthropic financially. But as time went on, it was a great opportunity to do all I could to help others less fortunate myself. So being invited on with those opportunities opening up, I was very fortunate. I think I was, for my age, I was very confident. I don't think I thought about myself much, but because I was interested, I did feel confident that I'd be able to make a good contribution.
Dame Elizabeth resigned from the Royal Children's Hospital Committee in 1965, having overseen the opening of a new hospital building in Royal Park.
Although I was still fairly young, I was a bit tired. Building a new hospital was a great thing, and I felt I probably had fulfilled my potential to help.
Do you see that as a bit of an end of an era in your philanthropic development, if you like?
Well, I think because my husband had been so interested and influential in the arts, I perhaps turned towards helping the arts. And that was a remarkable heritage that he left for me, because it opened up wonderful, interesting projects. You know, I was first woman member on the National Gallery of Victoria, so that was, you know, a tremendous step on, and that opened up all sorts of avenues for me.
Dame Elizabeth Murdoch is, of course, referring to her late husband, the newspaper proprietor, Sir Keith Murdoch. They married in June 1928, when the young Elizabeth Green was 19, half the age of her husband.
He was very idealistic and very philanthropic, and I think the example encouraged me.
Was he quite anonymous in his philanthropy?
Or? Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I was for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Yes. It was only when I realised that perhaps the example to other people might help. And I think, that, you know, sometimes one has to realise that it's not so helpful to be anonymous. I'm sometimes rather sad that people I know who could be so helpful and could get such pleasure out of it.
And the winner is Barbara Blackman for her generous philanthropy to fine music in Australia. It's a great honour, and I'm so happy to be counted among composers and performers, because I'm audience. And audience, I suppose, is the third dimension of music. And for me, music is a necessity. It's sort of the livelihood of my inner being. And I think we need live music publicly to keep our culture alive.
In 2006, one woman discovered the pleasure of philanthropy when she was awarded the Australian Contemporary Music Award for patronage. Barbara Blackman, author, artist's model and former wife of painter Charles Blackman, gave $1 million to chamber music in Australia, becoming the lead donor to the Australian Chamber Orchestra. Though blind since early adulthood, she toured with the ACO and took to the stage at each concert, delivering a powerful call to support music in Australia. Barbara Blackman's decision to give away $1 million came about in a curious way. While she was drawing up her will, close friend and executor Adrian Keenan put a novel suggestion to her.
He said, "Barbara, why don't we do it now and have fun?" And the now and the fun are two things that appeal to me. So we did. And the two of us formed ECMA, an enterprise to encourage, enlighten, explore, expand, extend contemporary music audience. I always feel a pang when I go to a concert, and contemporary music is very much my homing point, when there's wonderful music and not enough audience. So I directed it to that.
In 1928, Barbara Patterson was born in Brisbane and was raised by her mother Gertrude. They were not a wealthy family. Her life experience has given her a particular attitude to money, as indicated in this letter she wrote to the Sydney Morning Herald in 2006. It's read here by her friend Felicity Moore.
Money itself is a neutral entity. Its acquisition and use involves human purposes and prejudices. When a patron or philanthropist, live or dead, donates money, his motives cease to matter. The money returns to neutral. When this money is put to use, only the motives of the user matter. It is, in parlance of the day, a way of laundering the money from dirty to clean.
I grew up with a mother who was a treasurer and what was called a trust accountant with solicitors. So she had great responsibility of money, other people's money, and through sharing that with her, I have a great respect and disinterest in money, but I've never had the sort of ambitions in life that would be fulfilled with money, more money. My ambitions in life have been along the lines of my great friend Judith Wright, to live life and live it more poetically. And I think money, like fire, is a good servant and a very bad master. So I've always been rather pleased in being a minimalist and needing the smallest amount of money to get the maximum effect. And that pertained, of course, in the early time when we were in what's called the art world, and our attention was all on producing wonderful paintings and eating cheap and nourishing soup. And it was a good program of life. I've always enjoyed spending money usefully, and when I left the church, when I was about 20, 21, I left it knowing two things: God does answer prayer, and it's our duty to tithe.
Unlike her philanthropic predecessors, Barbara's religious lineage follows a peculiar path. Her great-grandfather was a Presbyterian minister, her grandfather a Mason, his brother a member of the Theosophical Society, her father a Rosicrucian, and Barbara, as she says, has chosen to follow the Sufi way. The philosophy around Sufism has fed into Barbara's philanthropy for nearly 30 years.
For the last several decades, I've had the opportunity to loan people money, and for a car, a house, dentistry, school fees, whatever. And I say, pay it back when and as you can. I don't supervise it. Actually, last week, someone phoned me. He said, I've done it. I've paid the last installment. This was $50,000 I loaned him 10 years ago. And I'm happy to have had that function in life of the Sufi land. Since the 80s, I've privately given $1,000 every year to someone who was in a pickle. say, a friend whose house burnt down, lost everything, or a man I know who works very hard with a small music group, and they work so hard, and he never has sort of money to buy himself a new jacket or... It's a windfall, and it's an uplift, and yes, that's my private pleasure, yes.
In many ways, I think you defy the stereotype of the woman philanthropist. You weren't born into money, nor did you marry into it. You're not a member of auxiliaries.
No, I defy just about every stereotype, Barbara. I'm afraid I don't fit it. I didn't come from a family in that sense. I mean, now I look back at it, and I came from a very responsible family on my father's side, mostly in the church, and mostly love through service in a church context. And I think that is something that is still in my core. There are others in greater need than oneself. But whether they're in need of soup kitchens or the best of music, we need both. But to have money and feel the power of it and be able to give it meaning, I think is wonderful.
Barbara Blackman began making regular philanthropic gifts in the 1980s. By then, much in the world of Australian philanthropy had changed. The social movements of the 1970s had left a very strong legacy and led to a change in the focus of philanthropy. Australia's post-war population had shifted dramatically, and philanthropic influences from other cultures were becoming apparent in this country, with Jewish philanthropy particularly strong here. More and more women were working, earning, and controlling money, and more were becoming involved in the administration of formalised philanthropic foundations. In the early 1970s, a young Jill Reichstein found herself at the helm of a large philanthropic foundation established by her father, the industrialist Lance Reichstein.
Well, I'd been a student at Monash University, where I was quite active in the Monash Labour Club and the politics of the Vietnam War and all of those things, and the women's movement. And at the time of my father establishing the foundation, I was working for the City of Brunswick in developing community-based childcare. So I knew very much what it was to write submissions, to work with community organisations. I'd been involved in the women's refuge movement, so I really had a strong sense of engaging with the people who you were working with, as opposed to working for, which for me has always been the charitable model. So I had a strong commitment that the foundation that my father had set up, which had been very traditional in giving to hospitals and charities and buses and blankets, that the foundation would grow into something that was supporting change at a community level. So supporting grassroots movements, initiatives, consumer control, advocacy, and that it would create a shift for the people whose lives. So, you know, a commitment to greater equity.
In her mid-30s, Jill Reichstein became chair of the Reichstein Foundation and actively demonstrated her own philosophies around community and philanthropy by making a number of significant changes. First step, the board of her own foundation.
The board was set up by my father, who appointed people who he worked with. So we had your usual accountant and lawyer and associates from his company, and his stockbroker. And so after my father died and I became involved, it was suggested that we might get some people on the board who had a little bit more knowledge about community issues by myself. And then gradually, as various board members retired, I kept appointing women. So we ended up with a board of women who had all been community activists in their time, some still were, and who really had a very strong knowledge base of community issues and how to structure community change.
Jill Reichstein was at the vanguard of a dramatic shift in philanthropy in Australia, which began in the 1970s and which was spearheaded, to a large degree, by women.
I think when I first got involved in philanthropy, there were very few like-minded people that saw philanthropy as a vehicle for social change. I was really pleased, through Mariel Wilmot, who then ran the Maher Foundation, to meet the Stegleys, Sarah and Brian Stegley, who really were soldiers in arms with me in the sense of really pushing the envelope. And then the Victorian Women's Trust evolved, and the community foundation model started to evolve when we started at Philanthropy Australia to talk about corporate social responsibility. It was really not something that many companies engaged in. The Anita Roddicks of this world were very few and far between. Now it's a considered good business practice to operate in that way, and if you have excess wealth, people expect you to give. Before, I think, 30 years ago when I first got involved, there was still a very strong sense of putting yourself out there. And there was certainly some sneering attitudes about wanting to do good and not really understanding where I was coming from. One particular interview I did, really what they wanted to know, what was the car I was driving? And I thought, they're so petty. So when journalists are open enough to see that you're not there just because you're trying to be a goody-goody or trying to get your name in print or using money as a vehicle for your own aggrandisement, which is what often people seem to assume that philanthropists are on about, and I'm not the philanthropist, it was my father who was the philanthropist, I'm just running his foundation. If the journalists get it right, you can have their descriptions of creating really positive change in the community can be very strong.
Do women do philanthropy differently?
A lot of the women that we've worked with and shared the giving experience with through Reichstein have been women who've inherited wealth and are very considered about how they distribute their funds. Some of them might only be distributing small amounts every year. For a lot of women who inherit money, they don't inherit the skills. They weren't groomed to be money managers, or that they've been encouraged to rely on the business people in the family or whatever. And increasingly, I'm seeing women get a lot more in control of those finances. Unless you have got a sound knowledge base of your money, you're never going to feel comfortable to give it away. I had to learn the hard way and improve my skills around those areas so that I could have an overview of the foundation and within my own life.
We're a group of women who want to act as catalysts to channel more philanthropic funds to projects which empower women and girls. We believe that to build better lives for men, women, children, families and communities, we have to get a greater proportion of philanthropic funds going to or through women and girls.
Last year, businesswoman, feminist and former lawyer Eve Marlab established the Funding Women Network. One of the network's board members, alongside Eve Marlab and Jill Reichstein, is Tony Joel, co-owner of a gift business in Melbourne. Tony's philanthropy involves 27,950 coats of various shapes and sizes in a project called Off Your Back.
Basically, the story is that we encourage people to take the coats out of their cupboards or off their back and give them to people who need them. So it originally started 4 years ago when I was walking down the street in Fitzroy Street and I saw a gentleman on a park bench and a little worse for wear. It was a freezing cold night and I had a coat and he didn't. And the first thought I had was I wanted to take it off my back and give it to him. But considering it was pink lined and had beautiful flowers over it and it wasn't the warmest of coats, I didn't think it was 100% appropriate. But it did actually plant a seed for me to think that if anyone went home and opened up their cupboards, there'd have to be at least one and maybe many more coats that, you know, we may not wear again, and someone else could benefit from it. So we ended up getting together about five or six of us. I was completely about the KISS principle, keep it simple. We weren't going to raise any money. We didn't want 1 cent of money to change hands. It was all about pulling in favours and seeing what we could do.
The youngest member of the Funding Women Network is Tricia Broadbridge, Young Australian of the Year of 2006. Trained as a youth worker, Tricia later moved into philanthropy, running youth programs for the Reach Foundation. She's now a consultant in philanthropy for ANZ trustees. In 2004, Tricia survived the Asian tsunami, but lost her husband, former Melbourne AFL player, Troy Broadbridge. Tricia set up the Reach Broadbridge Fund in his memory.
For me, in my journey, I started the Reach Broadbridge Fund, and I decided I wanted to build a school in Thailand after the 2004 tsunami. And at the time, I was grieving the loss of my husband, and people were sort of thought, how can this person build a school? Yes, she's a youth worker. Yes, she's worked in the sector, but is she going to be able to pull it off? And it was actually a family who have a foundation who gave me the first $25,000, and they backed me when no one else would. No corporates wanted to touch the idea because they thought that I wouldn't pull it off. So that was something that stayed with me forever, and I think it's something that's so important about this work is that it does give a lot of seed funding and really starts people up.
In her work, Tricia has had the opportunity to observe hundreds of Australian men and women in their approach to philanthropy. She and a number of the women interviewed for this program were able to offer some insight into the shifts and eddies of Australian women's giving over the decades.
I think for women it's a lot more emotional and there's a lot more attachment there. And generally women will know what it is they want to fund and exactly where they want the money to go, whereas men don't seem to have that same, from my experience, maybe don't have those same connections. Some do, but with women, usually straight away they know what it is they want to fund. I come from a generation where I give away money individually and have my own foundation, but I don't know a lot of women who are in that younger age bracket who are starting foundations, and I don't know whether it's got a lot to do with the fact that women have never really been in the financial position to do it. There might be a bit of fear around it as well, and it is very dominated by wealthy men.
As you know, I was Minister for Social Security for a very long time, 5 years, which is literally a lot of Australia. Yeah. And the participation of the religious and voluntary organisations in this country is quite unique. You will find that most of the services originated from the voluntary organisations, which were the charitable part of our community life. I would think there is now a change, inasmuch that there is not the time that women had in the years that I was very active. Women had time who were looking after their family and were, once married, not always returning to any kind of employment. Then when some of the organisations, like, say, Sir Optimus or the businesswomen were forming organisations, their approach to it was, well, we can't give time, but we can give money. That, to me, is still very much a charitable kind of spirit that's still there. Probably these girls were the girls whose mothers at home were always doing things when they were young, and they realised that, well, I can't do what my mother did, but I will be able to give charitably in donation to a lot of people. So I think that change is there, that the time that used to be spent is no longer available, but that there still should be that support that comes through with a benevolent spirit.
Basically, when I was younger, I was an advocate for the equality of men and women. And as I've got older and perhaps had more, resources myself, particularly financial resources, and yet perhaps a little less energy for the daily effort of being involved in organisations myself, I've turned my attention more to funding activities. And women have always been great at being involved in giving their labour and time in a philanthropic way, but I've become convinced that it now has to be followed by the increasing amount of money that women have control of.
And I think women increasingly
are playing a bigger role in philanthropy. I know that many of the community foundations are seeing a lot of women setting up funds and sub-funds. Women who are earning and creating their own wealth base are now starting to be very proactive in the philanthropic sector.
What is it then, do you think, that makes some people philanthropic where others who have the means are not?
I think they're just unimaginative. And I think there's a lot of wonderfully goodwill and good intentions and in our community. A lot of generosity, I think. Not only generosity, I think generosity of spirit.
We've given away whatever we've personally given away, but it's not about that. It's about the fact that we've been able to inspire thousands and thousands of other people, so tens of thousands now, of other people to take the coats out of their cupboards as well.
I think that philanthropy's in a really good place at the moment. It's being talked about in lots of different arenas. Business community, the social venture network is starting to take off here. So that means that there's a lot more money out there, but it also means there's a big challenge, I think, to connect community sector with those who are doing the giving, so that the donor actually experiences an engagement and can fund passionately, and the community sector is able to present the issues in a way that is being heard.
The thing that I love about this sector is that this is money that goes on forever, and I think it's so important that it's maybe easier to write a $10,000 check to a World Vision or a big organisation, but this way, if you invest your money, this is perpetual and it goes on forever. And to me, that is what's going to make social change.
Barbara, I have to tell you, if I'd said, whoopee, I've got $1 million, I'm going to do this and do that and go hither and thither and spend it on myself, I couldn't have had anything like the fun and excitement I have had by being taken to the bosom of the people who make music. It has just opened up a wonderful life experience for me.
Without philanthropy, do you think life would be boring or empty for you?
No, but I mean, it's richly rewarding when you are able to be philanthropic because, you know, it's so warmly appreciated and you really feel that you are doing good, making a difference to other people's lives, and that's very satisfying. Well, aren't I lucky to have had the opportunity, you see? I think it's wonderful that at 98 and a half, I'm still able to be involved in interesting activities. It's remarkable.
You've been listening to A Great Form of Love, the history of women philanthropists in Australia. It was presented and produced by Barbara Lemon, and the sound engineer was Russell Thompson. And thanks to those women who took part in today's program: Heather Matthew, Dame Margaret Guilfoyle, Dame Elizabeth Murdoch, Barbara Blackman, Jill Reichstein, Eve Marlab, Tony Joel, and Tricia Broadbridge. Thanks also to Sally Coburn, Felicity Moore, and the National Foundation of Australian Women. And I hope you'll join me next week on Hindsight for the first of a two-part series which explores histories of women and the demon drink. In Program 1, 6 o'clock closing, we raise a glass of fruit cup and explore the history of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, whose grit, grace and gumption still shapes attitudes to modernity and moral hygiene today.
We, women of this nation, conscious of the great evils and appalled by the dangers of intemperance, band ourselves together for the promotion of total abstinence and the entire extinction of the liquor traffic.
Of the doings will help you along. When you're discouraged and things all go wrong.
A fruit cup inspired taste of 6 o'clock closing. The story of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. That's next week on Hindsight, here on your national network, ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.